again, I'm not trying to promote misinformation. I'm not trying to be controversial. I've never tried to do anything with this podcast other than just talk to people and have interesting conversations. So my pledge to you is that I will do my best to try to balance out these more controversial viewpoints with other people's perspectives so we can maybe find a better point of view.
Podcaster Joe Rogan, in a video he released on Instagram yesterday, he and Spotify have been forced to respond to mounting public criticism that his show promotes COVID misinformation. It started last week when musician Neil Young demanded that his music catalog be removed from the streaming service over Rogan's comments. Joni Mitchell followed. Author and self-help guru Brené Brown also said she'll stop releasing new episodes of her Spotify-exclusive podcast, though she didn't specifically tie that decision to Rogan. Here to talk about all this is Kevin Roos, tech columnist for The New York Times. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Spotify posted a big blog post yesterday apologizing for not being more transparent about its content rules. It said it would include disclaimers on COVID-19 content. So is that going to be enough to tamp this down, this fury, this outrage?
No, I mean, this is the way that platforms always start with these controversies. They say, you know, we're committed to free speech and we're, you know, we'll put these other tools on our platform that'll direct people to better information, but we're not going to, you know, censor people. We don't want to be the speech police. But what makes this really different than, I mean, we've seen this kind of thing happen over and over again with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. But what makes this thing with Spotify and Joe Rogan different is that Spotify paid Joe Rogan more than $100 million in 2020 to be the exclusive distributor of his podcast. So they are responsible for his output in a way that, say, Facebook is not necessarily responsible for the controversial creators on its platform.
Is it kind of like Netflix and Dave Chappelle? Is it a similar situation? And that kind of blew over.
Yeah, it's more like that. And it might blow over if people, you know, move on and decide there are other things to be mad about. But I think this could really snowball. We're starting to see not just Joni Mitchell and Neil Young pulling their music, but now podcasters with exclusive Spotify deals like Brené Brown are, you know, sort of withholding their podcast from the platform in protest. So I really think that Spotify is in a bind here, and it can't just do the sort of we're a neutral platform argument to get out of it. It's really got to deal with this head on.
So I guess I'm wondering how big a deal this is with the Spotify subscribers, because Spotify does rely on subscribers more than advertisers. And does its listening base really care if a bunch of baby boomers pull their content?
Well, maybe not the baby boomers pulling their content, but a platform like Spotify really depends on having very popular music on its platform. So I think there is a number, and I don't know whether it's 10 or 20 or 100, but if a lot of the top artists on Spotify got together and said, we're going to withhold our music from this platform unless you do what we want, that could have a real effect. I mean, if you can't get Joni Mitchell and Neil Young on Spotify, maybe that's not such a big deal. But if it's, you know, if it's Lil Nas X and Olivia Rodrigo and Beyonce and, you know, other huge, huge best-selling artists, then you're not really a viable streaming platform anymore.
Right. So if Drake or Beyonce, as you say, decide to do that, are there any murmurings that that is going to happen, that really popular artists are going to follow suit? Taylor Swift, for example?
Well, I just got a note in my inbox saying that the Village People are considering pulling their music from Spotify, but I don't think that one's going to tip the scales, although it would be very sad for me personally as a fan of YMCA.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, the more current artists, the artists who are getting a huge number of streams, they're not making noise yet about withholding their content, but Joe Rogan in his sort of half apology video did hint that Spotify had other artists threaten to remove their content as well.
Well, let's talk about Joe Rogan and what he said yesterday. He positions himself as this genial everyman, and he said, I'm not trying to be controversial. I'm not trying to spread misinformation. And even I am surprised by how this has become such a juggernaut, his podcast, that it's kind of, he said it was out of control. How much is that Is that true? And if so, does he have responsibility for it? Does Spotify, who does bear the ultimate responsibility for the content?
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe Rogan is counting on the fact that a lot of the people criticizing haven't actually listened to his show. Like, I've been listening to Joe Rogan's show for a long time, and this is not shocking behavior from him. He has been raising, conspiracy theories about COVID since almost the beginning of the pandemic. He is a longtime dabbler in misinformation and conspiracy theories. And that's not, you know, all he does, but it's certainly part of what he's been doing for a very long time. So I think this is, for listeners of Joe Rogan, maybe they're not surprised by this most recent controversy, but I think for people looking in, especially in the middle of a pandemic that is, you know, lingering in part because people are being fed, you know, misinformation and mistruths about this virus and the vaccines, I think it's, you know, this newfound spotlight on him is very uncomfortable, and I can see why he wants to get out of it.
Well, right. He's put himself in a position of being a journalist in a way, and he's just not. He said, oh, I'm just having conversations with my friends. But yet he is now in a position of great influence. And when it comes to this kind of topic, this is something that is normally handled by people with more experience or information, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, he is doing some of this through interviews, and you know, some of what he's been getting heat for are not things that he himself said. They're things his guests said. But he has also said, you know, plenty of things over the years that would be, you know, cause for controversy. He's made his own, high profile, statements about COVID that didn't turn out to be true or that were based on false information. Mm-hmm. So he has actively misled his audience. It's not just that he's asking questions of these guests.
Yeah. Right. How many downloads does he get? What is his influence?
Millions. I mean, he's the biggest podcaster on Spotify. He was their most listened to podcaster of the year last year. He's been one of the largest figures in the podcast world for a number of years. So he is basically their headline act, and he has been relentlessly promoted inside their app, ever since that deal got done. So they have really invested in him as a sort of marquee performer for them. And this is what you get. This is the responsibility that they've taken on as a result of doing this deal with him.
So how do you see this playing out?
Right now, I'm waiting to see sort of what the next dominoes to fall are. If there are more artists who start pulling their music from Spotify, I think the platform could be forced to do more than it's currently doing. It could also blow over, like we saw with the Netflix controversy with Dave Chappelle last year. I think it also sort of depends on what Joe Rogan does. If he backs off and steps away from this more controversial content, I think he, you know, could keep his deal and people would move on. If he doubles down and starts, you know, interviewing more controversial guests and saying more false things about COVID, I think it could get worse for him.
Kevin Roos, New York Times tech columnist. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, at a Saturday night rally in Texas, former President Trump floated the idea of pardoning the January 6th insurrectionists.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
Meanwhile, the Congressional Committee investigating January 6th has subpoenaed a slate of fake electors from states President Biden won. We're going to talk about this now with Press Play's Legal Eagle, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Among her many talents, she is an expert on election law. Welcome.
Well, hello. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. So what do you make of what Trump said just right there? Obviously, he has no pardon power at the moment. He's a private citizen. But if he is potentially influencing someone, how they might plea, their cooperation, what have you, by dangling a carrot like this and then does win re-election, could that be considered obstruction of justice?
So I think it's too attenuated because at this point, he's basically, Madeline, in the same position as you are or as I am, in the sense of if I said, you know, if I run and if I win, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure, and the kind of fill in the blank, if you engage in this type of crime, you will never be subject to the death penalty, or I will make sure to commute your sentence, or I will make sure to pardon you. I don't have that power right now. Now, of course, he might. And we did have this conversation when he, in fact, did have the pardon power. And he was kind of hinting to people like Michael Flynn or Steve Bannon, you know, don't cooperate. And then I think there's a real argument to be made about whether or not that is obstruction of justice. I think in this case, because there's those two ifs, if I run, if I win, and then of course we know that he wouldn't necessarily follow through on that, that it's just too, there's too many links in the chain.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the committee subpoenaing 14 people who said that they were electors for Trump from states that Biden won. They were not electors for Trump. Who are they? What were they trying to do? And who was orchestrating all that?
Well, there are people who were submitting false votes. So they're basically trying to create a shadow system of electors. I mean, it's, we can think about this in our daily lives, maybe the same way that people who lost a bid for Congress might say, you know what, I know I lost, but I think I'm actually going to go to DC and I'm going to start voting, and people should really adhere to that. Now, in terms of who they are, they're people who are members of, in some cases, the Republican Party, who are actually elected members of the Republican Party, people who are members of groups, obviously all who support Trump. And what they were trying to do is say, well, we're going to submit an alternative slate. So even though Trump lost, and they may or may not have believed that, this state, we're going to send to Congress and to the National Archives our names as if, in an alternate reality, in fact, Trump won. And we know that they met in December. We know that this was organized. This was an open meeting. And what did they try and do here? I mean, this is part of what I view as an attempt of a self-coup to overturn a valid presidential election.
So why did they think that this would work if they were plotting this out in the open and it was so obviously fake?
So, you know, I go up and back about this. On the one hand, we could say it was to placate President Trump. And so maybe they knew that it wasn't going to win, it wasn't going to work, or at the very best, it would be a huge long shot, but they were at least currying favor with President Trump. It may also be because there were lawyers who were writing memos on this, that at least some of the people thought that they were going to succeed. And let's remember, we actually came rather close, or I would say perilously close, to a much, much more difficult situation. So the Electoral Count Act empowers the current vice president to basically count up and certify those Electoral College votes. If he had said, there seems to be some problems with the slates, we're in a kind of extra constitutional realm that is completely unprecedented. So I would say it failed, and it should have failed. And in so many ways, it was just, you know, an exercise in imaginary thinking. On the other hand, if Mike Pence hadn't followed the Constitution, we could have been living in that alternate reality.
Which is why Congress is trying to shore this up, the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and to make it more difficult, and to just make it clearer that the vice president doesn't have the ability to do that, and make it more difficult to raise an objection, right?
Exactly. They're really trying to focus on two things. It should be harder to raise an objection. Now I think it's one member of each of Congress and the Senate. It should be harder to basically say, yes, there's a real objection here, to weigh in on the objection. And we should take the vice president out of this. So the vice president is sometimes somebody who is running. In this case, you know, Mike Pence was running to be reelected as the vice president. Or let's think about Al Gore, somebody who is actually running to be the president. And they're saying, let's maybe make it the Senate pro tem. Let's try and take the politics out of that. Whenever you see a statute that says of 1887, it might be time to revise it.
Okay, let's switch gears. Speaking of people who were once mentioned as possible presidential candidates, Michael Avenatti, the disgraced attorney. He was the Stormy Daniels lawyer when she accused Trump of all sorts of wrongdoing. And now he and she are on opposite sides in a courtroom. Can you talk about what's happening?
I can talk about what feels like an alternate universe. So in this case, we're talking about a case where Michael Avenatti is accused of stealing money from Stormy Daniels, that she got a book advance and basically that he took that book advance of about $300,000, didn't tell her. This is somewhat similar, although different, from charges he's facing in Orange County, where he's accused of taking money from clients, taking their settlements, et cetera. In this case, of course, what was particularly interesting is what happened in the courtroom, where Avenatti cross-examined Stormy Daniels and really, let's say, tried to undermine her credibility by bringing up some maybe questionable beliefs that she holds and really trying to make her look like somebody who could not be believed.
Right. He was asking her if she had X-ray vision and whether she talks to a haunted doll named Susan. Is that right?
Among other things, yes, whether or not she's had visions of dead people, has spoken to dead people, has said that she might think she could be crazy, wishes that he will be raped when in prison. And then, of course, the doll named Susan also played a role in what increasingly feels like a theater inside a courtroom. But yes, all of these things came up. What does it fall under in terms of our legal analysis? Again, falls within the guise of you cannot trust her. If she's this prosecution star witness, then the prosecution doesn't have a case. That's at least what he's trying to argue.
Right. And this is, as you say, just one of three trials that he's facing. He's already faced one and been found guilty.
He's faced one where essentially dealing with kind of extortion claims and Nike. He's facing another in Orange County dealing with taking his client's money and wire fraud. There was a mistrial declared in that case. It will be tried again, I believe. And this case, of course, is ongoing right now, dealing with allegations that he stole Stormy Daniels' book advance.
Wow. Okay. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, remember all those packages stolen from cargo trains in LA? Well, there were a lot of guns stolen there too. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles police have been quietly investigating dozens of missing guns. They were stolen back in August from cargo trains in LA's Lincoln Heights neighborhood. You've probably seen those viral photos of packages ransacked at the rail yard. Joining us now is Richard Winton. He covers crime and investigations for the LA Times. Welcome back, Richard.
Nice to be here.
Well, how many guns are thought to be missing and stolen off these train cars?
Well, at this point, this is what we know. There are 36 handguns, 22 revolvers, and 46 shotguns. Those are the ones they know about because when they found last August, they basically caught two guys with two of the handguns, started tracing them. And then they caught a third guy. And basically one of them admitted, oh yeah, well, I didn't get one of the shotguns. They couldn't really afford those. And then they realized, hold a second, it's not just handguns, there's shotguns. So they tracked a couple of loads which went missing, realized that they've been taken from the yards, along with many people have probably seen that things are being taken from the trains there. Mm-hmm. And they know so far about these guns being taken. There could be others. I also was told there's a very strong likelihood that ammunition was taken at some stage as well. These are, in fact, some of the people who I talked to at LAPD who have been investigating this tell me this isn't even that unique, in that they also later learned that Pomona, Commerce, San Pedro had incidents. And, you know, frankly, in Chicago 5 or 6 years ago, a very similar series of crimes occurred on the south side of the city in the train yards.
Wow. So this is not new. It seems new here in LA, but has this been going on maybe here for a while?
The honest truth is the LAPD people who are investigating this told me we don't really know how much has been taken, because reporting it, basically guns go missing before that. These are being wholesale delivered to someone, not one or two. We're talking whole boxes to be delivered to a business somewhere. In this case, it turned out they were going to Tennessee, but if they don't turn up, eventually someone files some paperwork saying, hey, these didn't arrive. It's kind of like when you get your Amazon package and it doesn't turn up, and what do? You eventually report it. Well, they do the same thing. The only reason the LAPD got onto this is basically when they caught people with some shiny new guns, which just didn't look like your typical weapons found by people when you detain them on the street. You know, there was pretty much, okay, these are new guns. Where are they coming from? And so the real truth is that at this stage, they don't know. There are a lot more. But they do know that, you know, people were taking guns. And this was orchestrated as well by not just individuals. There was gang organization, you know, on the east side of LA who had realized, hey, there's more than just, Bluetooth speakers and things down in those trains. We might find some really other more interesting stuff.
Okay, so that gets to the bigger question as to why this is happening in the first place at all, why there isn't more security. And if guns are being sent via the trains, there should be a lot more extra security. Why isn't there?
Well, this is a very good question. So we have a great deal of mileage, thousands of miles of train track in California. And Union Pacific, which basically, so the rails, and they're at a very historic, obviously, probably everyone's, you know, realizes the railroads are as old as America. Mm-hmm. And so is pretty much the laws which govern them. So for instance, Union Pacific has its own police force, essentially. Their own special agents who in theory are meant to be the ones who guard these right-of-ways. They number very small. There's some, and we've been told by multiple people involved that the number of people who actually patrol these areas have become smaller over the years. So you probably can count them on your two hands, the number of actual agents between here and Arizona who are actually assigned by Union Pacific to protect and investigate these lines, which has left essentially local authorities trying to protect and investigate hundreds of miles of lines. And whenever these trains stop, people have realized they're somewhat vulnerable. They're not heavily guarded. The only time a train's really get guarded is if they put something like a tank on it or something really military, then they do actually put people with it. But, you know, most of the time these trains are somewhat vulnerable when they sit, you know, when the cargo just sits there, you know, often overnight. Yeah. And that's when people move in, you know, it, as I understand it, what's happened is in some cases initially, you know, some gang members were targeting the stuff, then it spread and basically the gang members became somewhat lazy and decided, hey, you know what, let me recruit people who are unhoused who maybe, you know, need money, or and we'll get them to take the stuff off the train for us, and then we'll fence it back through someone else and pay them, you know, pennies on the dollar for the things they get, and that kind of thing has become.
So do the rail companies, Union Pacific, do they just not see it in their financial interest as to hire more security?
The insurance industry people essentially suggest that's what goes on. There's a sort of a sort of balancing act. And it's the same reason why, you know, you think someone would, like the providers like Amazon, and people are putting masses of stuff onto these trains, you think they would want to be more aggressive and do something. Well, there comes a point at which they try to balance how much we spend to try and protect these things by how much you just, we write off as loss, you know, and there seems to be a degree of write off as loss. Now, unfortunately, it turns out not everything on that train is, you know, a Bluetooth speaker or something which is expendable. And now we've got like guns and bullets move on those trains, because in the end, trains move pretty much everything at some stage. Even if it ends up on a truck, often it starts off, it comes out of the port on a train and then gets offloaded somewhere in, say, the Inland Empire, onto the trucks, which then put it across the country. But often it just moves right across the country till it gets to one of the other big cities, and then they do the offloading there.
What about local prosecutors? Couldn't they step up their prosecution, or the police, the local police, just stake it out and arrest people as they are?
Well, there's an ongoing, there's already on this case been an ongoing war of words between all the parties involved. LAPD, the captain locally told me, yeah, we made a combined with all the other agents, including Union Pacific, about 128 arrests, but we've only, you know, had a handful of, you know, actual charges filed. Union Pacific, which it seemed like a move which was somewhat PR oriented, basically wrote a letter to George Gascon saying he's the DA in Los Angeles saying he's not doing enough. And not surprisingly, he responded by citing numbers back to them saying, you're actually arresting fewer people than you're claiming, you know, the number of these thefts mm-hmm. is going up. You're arresting about half as many people as you used to. And I am prosecuting about half the people you send me. But a lot of the time you don't have proper evidence. You know, there is issues with being able to determine, you know, whose items they're actually taking. In other words, who's actually the victim? Because, you know, obviously you catch someone with stolen property, which is typically a scenario. The person's not caught like on the train or right there. They're caught like two streets away. I mean, the top examples are, you know, they could catch people with things like two streets away, which are clearly brand new. They're hauling them down the street and they arrest them for, you know, property theft. And then you've got to literally prove they took it, and you've got to literally prove who more importantly, who they stole it from, which can be actually the hardest bit, according to the LAPD captain. It's very hard. Yeah. But when it comes to the guns, when it comes to the guns, this thing's got a lot more serious very quickly.
Absolutely. Richard, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
Richard Winton, he covers crime and investigations for the LA Times. Coming up, the first and only female conductor of a major U.S. symphony, Maren Alsop. She wanted to be a conductor since she was a little girl.
Music became a refuge in a way. I think it was a place to immerse myself. It was a whole world.
Maren Alsop is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There are no female conductors at any of America's top orchestras. Not one. Until last year, there was one, Maren Alsop. She led the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra for 14 years until she stepped down last June. Maren Alsop had to fight her entire life to get there, and that story is told in a new documentary. It's called The Conductor, and Maren Alsop joins me now. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, that is a depressing fact that there are no female conductors at any of the top orchestras. Although, I will say, a French conductor, an opera singer named Nathalie Stutzman, has been hired by Atlanta for the upcoming season. So there will be one. But did you think your 14 years leading the Baltimore Symphony would have opened more doors by now for other women?
Yeah, I would have hoped so. Certainly, I expected to see more women on the podiums with the upper ranks of the orchestras, you know, the higher ranked orchestras. But it really didn't change much. And even in terms of guest conducting, I have to say it's only within probably the past 4 to 5 years, you know, since the Me Too movement, that we've seen many more women as guest conductors in the top ranks.
So why do you think that is? Because there are other professions, other artistic endeavors that don't see this incredible disparity between men and women at the top?
Well, I think so much of it is habitual and what people are used to seeing. And it becomes, I think, a bit of a vicious cycle, because if you don't see any women in these roles, then people aren't comfortable with women in those roles. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not enough just to see one woman. You have to see many women, you know, women of different nationalities, of different ethnicities, of different ages, you know, so that you start getting used to the idea of the generic woman in this role. And, you know, I think we're a long way from that still.
Yeah. Well, what is it like for you when you're up there on the podium? And are you conscious of the fact that people are looking at you as a woman?
Oh, of course not. No. I mean, conducting is all about gesture and body language. And of course, body language, the same gesture from a man is not interpreted the same way by society as the the exact same gesture from a woman necessarily. You know, we expect men to have very strong handshakes when we meet them, right? You know, that's sort of a sign of virility and strength. When women have strong handshakes, people are frightened by it. You know, it's a different reaction. So even in that small example of something we experience every day, people are making judgments. And so I work very hard with my, especially with my students, to kind of try to de-genderize gesture so that it is about the music and it's not about any ancillary sort of stereotypic connections.
So that people, the audience, will just forget that they're watching a woman conductor, but just a conductor, and a very good one at that.
Well, yeah, and not just the audience. I mean, first and foremost, the musicians, and then through the musicians, the audience, yes.
I want to play a clip of tape from the movie about you recalling working with Leonard Bernstein at Tanglewood. This is when you were studying with him before you were hired at Baltimore, and you were young, and you were working with your idol, your mentor, and he was watching you conduct, or more accurately, listening to you conduct, and here's the clip.
He was really lost in thought. He said, you know, I just don't get it. I don't understand. Uh-oh, what? I said, what is it? He said, when I close my eyes, I can't tell you're a woman. So I said, well, listen, if you're more comfortable with your eyes closed, I'm good with that. You know, you can come to all my concerts and close your eyes.
So tell me more about your reaction to what he said.
Well, he was of a generation, you know, that really didn't consider women in certain roles in society, and particularly in the role, you know, of his profession. That said, he was probably the most supportive mentor to women conductors. I mean, he hired the first woman assistant conductor at the New York Philharmonic in the 60s, and he had to have the New York Philharmonic's bylaws changed so that she could conduct the orchestra. So he was way ahead of his time in terms of trying to create opportunities for women. But I think he was still of a generation that couldn't quite figure it out. Do you know what I mean? Like, how is this possible? This isn't really what I'm used to. And I wasn't being, I mean, I was being kind of cheeky, but I wasn't being really insincere in that I understood that he valued me not as a woman conductor, but as a talented young conductor, period, the end. He never judged me based on that, never.
He was your idol since you were really young, since you first saw him conduct. You were, what, 9 years old?
Yeah, and my dad took me to a concert that he conducted, and when he came out and he talked to the audience, I mean, I felt like he was talking to me, you know, oh, Marin, here, I want to share with you, talk to you about this. Yeah, of course, he was talking to everybody, but it felt so personal. He was so passionate and enthusiastic and charismatic. And then when he turned back to the orchestra, he was joyous, you know, filled with love and embrace and fun. He was having a good time. And I felt, even at that point, 9 years old, I had already been playing piano and violin for quite a while. And I was a little bit suspicious that classical music had too many rules. And when I saw Bernstein jumping around, I thought, okay, this classical music thing isn't so bad. Maybe I could be the conductor.
Your parents were both musicians, and did they encourage you?
Well, they, you know, as long as I was going to be a musician, they were happy. So did they encourage me? I would say it bordered on being forced into it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was no alternative avenue open to me, really. But that said, when I first told my violin teacher at Juilliard that I wanted to be a conductor, she said, oh, you know, you're too young and girls don't do that. When I told my parents, oh, my mother was just hopping mad. And my father, when I came down to breakfast the next day, he had bought me a long wooden box, and I unlatched it and opened it up, and he had filled it with batons. So it was incredibly supportive and he was saying, we will try to give you the tools to do what you want to do.
But you were an only child and they were away a lot. They were freelance musicians. And it sounds like you had a pretty lonely childhood. What role did music play in your childhood?
I mean, it was quite lonely. And of course, they were away every night at shows at the New York City Ballet. So music became a refuge in a way. I think it was a place to immerse myself. It was a whole world. It was filled with emotion. It was filled with validation. And of course, it was filled with a lot of other people often because I loved playing chamber music. And I started playing in the orchestra when I was quite young, 7, 8 years old. It became that family that I longed for. And the idea of being the conductor and being able to connect with 100 people became extremely attractive, not only from a musical standpoint, but from a psychological and social standpoint for me.
You're also now a teacher and a mentor to young would-be composers and young women composers. And I just want to play a clip of tape of you teaching conducting.
Build up and yeah, right. But it feels a little like a little bit stuck, you know, instead of that kind of thing. Yes, sustain. Oh, energy, energy. It's the life of the party. Come on. Spark, sparky. And sustain on the violin's land. Yeah. For me, it's much better.
How do you teach conducting and what makes for a good conductor?
Yeah, I mean, teaching conducting is really a joy because it's really a metaphor for who the student is. It's the person you are. It's about motivating people. It's about enabling artists to be the best they can be. That's what a great conductor is. And, you know, there are fundamentals of conducting, of course, a basic technical things that we work on. You have to figure out how to have supreme independence of your hands. You have to be multitasking constantly, connecting with 100 people at one time, completely organized about your rehearsal. I mean, it's a formidable skill set to master. But I think what I notice the most is that the students that can have the greatest amount of self-awareness are the ones that become the best conductors, because it's all about who you are.
Do you feel exposed when you're standing up there?
Oh, absolutely. It's a profession, I think, of allowing yourself to be vulnerable, but not weak. You know, you have to be emotionally vulnerable, but also completely in charge. So it's a tour de force of extremes, I would say. And what's so fascinating to me is that many, many conductors, many of the students I have are introverts. And I find that really interesting because often conducting, I think, is a reaction and a desire to reach outside of this introverted nature and connect on a much broader scale.
Are you an introvert?
I am. I don't think I'm an extreme introvert, but I do think that's my basic nature, yeah. Mm.
So why did you step down from leading the Baltimore Symphony? You were there for 14 years. Was it just time for a change?
Well, 14 years as music director, that's a pretty substantive tenure. I think I'm the longest serving music director of the Baltimore Symphony in its history. And I decided that I really wanted to focus more on my work in Europe. And I'm now the chief conductor of the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra. And I also work with now the Chicago Symphony at the Ravinia Festival in the summer. So there were a lot of competing opportunities for my time. And it seemed like the right moment to move forward. And the great news for me is that I have an ongoing relationship with the Baltimore Symphony, and I conduct 3 weeks every year, at least for the next few years. So I'm happy to still be having a strong relationship with the orchestra.
Well, not only that, you have founded all sorts of educational organizations, including Orc Kids in Baltimore. Can you just describe that? Because it's been described in the New York Times as groundbreaking.
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, one of the things that has always struck me about symphony orchestras, especially in the United States, but I think globally, is the lack of diversity on the stage. And that's because all kids do not have the same opportunities to learn an instrument. You have to start very, very young. And a lot of kids, especially economically challenged families who really don't have extra income to, you know, have private lessons or buy instruments, don't have the same opportunities. So I thought, I wonder what would happen if all kids had the same opportunity. So we began with 30 kids, 30 first graders, and it was amazing. First of all, the kids, they glommed onto music and they ran with it. And from 30 kids, it grew to over 2,000 kids in Baltimore, traveling the world, playing in orchestras, playing in jazz bands, playing in chamber music, playing in bucket band, and really using music as a vehicle to envision themselves doing anything they feel like doing in life. And it's been very empowering and very inspiring, I have to say.
Well, definitely. And so how do you see yourself as someone who is a teacher more than a performer in a way?
I don't think so. I think I'm a performer, but I don't think they're exclusive at all. I think because I'm a performer and I'm out there working and having these experiences day in, day out, I think it enables me to bring that to my teaching and share those experiences with young people, and also to try to inspire them to be the best they can be, and that there's room for everyone in this field.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Maren Alsop. She's the subject of a new documentary. It's called The Conductor, and it'll be at the Lemley Royal Theater here in Los Angeles this Friday. Coming up, the Sklar brothers will be here to talk about the big weekend in sports. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
The LA Rams will have home field advantage against the Cincinnati Bengals for the Super Bowl in 2 weeks. The Rams secured their spot yesterday when they beat the San Francisco 49ers by 3 points in a fourth quarter comeback, and a major interception in the final minutes of the game sealed their win.
Garoppolo under pressure.
Joining us to talk about the big games, plus the record-breaking five and a half hours tennis final in Australia are the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Hi, guys.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine. It was an endurance test for sports fans this weekend. Oh, my gosh. Okay,
great.
Yeah, it was a great weekend all the way around. All right, let's talk about the Rams and the 49ers and catch us up on that game. Talk about the last minutes or so, the final finish.
So it was, you know, we talked about this last week before the game in anticipation. It's really hard to beat a team three times in one season because you start to notice their tendencies and you start to game plan for that. And in the two previous games where San Francisco's won the last six games against the Rams, and they're an divisional foe, and, you know, they ran kind of roughshod over them and really bullied the Rams. So the Rams, it was really interesting. They were down 17-7 with 2 minutes left in the third quarter. And you said to yourself, you know, this game could be over for the Rams. But mm-hmm. what they did was they really focused on stopping the run from San Francisco and put all of it on San Francisco's quarterback, Jimmy Garoppolo, and said, you beat us. We're going to see if you can beat us. And truthfully, Matthew Stafford, the quarterback for the Rams, is just a better quarterback than Jimmy Garoppolo. And in the end and in the fourth quarter, he took the Rams down. They scored a couple times. They kicked a couple of field goals, and they wound up winning the game. And really, Stafford showed that he could put the Rams on his back and carry them to victory, and Garoppolo fell a little bit short.
Well, how do the two quarterbacks stack up, the Bengals quarterback and the Rams quarterback? How do they stack up against each other? Who has the advantage, or are they pretty much equal?
I mean, they're so different because Joe Burrow is only in his second year in the league, and it's the youngest player. He's the youngest player ever to reach a Super Bowl. He won the Heisman Trophy. He brought LSU a national championship. I mean, he's such an interesting story. He sat on the bench and was a backup at Ohio State after being a high-level recruit, transferred to LSU, then won the Heisman Trophy for best player in college football, led them to a national championship, came to Cincinnati. Remember, 3 years ago, Cincinnati had the worst record in the NFL. Last year, they only won 4 games. But now he has taken them all the way to the Super Bowl. He's that much of a talent. He just wins. If you watch the game against Kansas City, there were numerous situations where he was in the grasp of a defender and broke free and then made an amazing pass. He is one of those players who they say has an aura of winning around him. Matthew Stafford, on the other hand, for the Rams, was a guy who kind of toiled in Detroit for years and years, had tremendous talent, just didn't have the team around him. He's a veteran, though, and he's a guy who everyone has said, hey, this is his shot. He's been in the league for a long time. He knows what he's doing, but he's never had a chance to make it to a Super Bowl. So he's kind of a Super Bowl rookie too. It's going to be really exciting for both of those guys to square off.
Yeah. And so who is the favored overall?
So right now, the opening betting line, which kind of tells you where people's minds are at, the Rams are up a couple of points. I think the Rams are maybe 3-point favorites, 3.5-point favorites. And I would agree with that on, you know, in one case, but it's hard to bet against this guy, Joe Burrow. Joe Burrow went into, you know, Kansas City, who had hosted the last 4 AFC championship games and won that game, literally took that game from them. And so he's been in really difficult situations before and come out victorious. The interesting thing is that the Rams are kind of considered a bit of like a super team. So they got Matt Stafford. They got a great receiver, Odell Beckham Jr., who was fantastic for the Giants, then kind of had a lot of trouble in the clubhouse in Cleveland, and now he's here. They have a bunch of pieces like that were stars elsewhere and put them together, whereas Cincinnati feels a little more like they did it through the draft and homegrown guys. So it's interesting to see those two styles up against each other. You have a lot of veterans on the Rams, and they've been there, a bunch of them. They were in the Super Bowl a couple years ago. And then, you know, Cincinnati is kind of all newbies. They may be too kind of, now I won't say stupid, but
ignorant
to know how big of a situation this is, which actually can play into your benefit. So it's just two different styles. But it's a home game also for the Rams. I mean, we have to play that field advantage a little bit. They're comfortable. They understand the setting there. They've played there so much. They're going to be at home. By the way, yesterday we had a friend who went to the game. He said it felt like there were about 75% of those fans were 49ers fans, even though it was a home game for the Rams. There were more 49ers. Right. We talked about them. Yeah, no, they're not banned. I mean, like, you know, look, there are a lot of transplants, as you know. LA is full of everybody who came from somewhere else. There are a lot of San Francisco people down here. And he said that stadium was a sea of red yesterday.
Okay, let's move on to the Australian Open. That was quite a game, that last game. What, 5.5 hours between Rafa and Medvedev?
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
Yes.
Put it into context, into tennis history context.
I mean, it was there was the classic Wimbledon Borg versus McEnroe that went so long in the final set. There have been some classics before. The reason why this one was so significant is, number one, how old Nadal is, and the fact that Nadal, with this win, he is now has the most Grand Slam titles in history at 21, one more than Roger Federer and Djokovic. And if you try to put that in a context of all time, that 21, Bjorn Borg had 11. John McEnroe had 8.
He had 7.
7. Andre Agassi had 8. Andre Agassi had 8. Pete Sampras had 14. So 21 is tremendous. Now, you also think about Rafa Nadal is the master of the French Open, even though he's Spanish. He's from Spain. He's the master of the French Open. He's won 13 French Opens. That's one of the four Grand Slams. So he's dominated there. But he's also won some Wimbledons, and he's also won, and he's won in, at the Australian Open. Now he's won 2. So it's tremendous. This victory, some people say this makes him the GOAT. This makes him the greatest of all time. I'm not sure because Djokovic is still playing.
He's still pretty active. I mean, the interesting thing is that, you know, Nadal's first Grand Slam win was in 2005. And now he's got this one in 2022, 17 years between the first and the last one. It's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. It's just the beginning of the year, too. So more tennis to watch from him going forward. The Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason, check out their podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.